Chapter 12, Promenading with Lunatics. I shall never forget my first walk. When all the patients had donned the white straw hats, such as bathers wear at Coney Island, I could not but laugh at their comical appearances. I could not distinguish one woman from another. I lost Miss Neville and had to take my hat off and search for her. When we met, we put our hats on and laughed at one another. Two by two, we formed in line, and guarded by the attendants, we went out a back way onto the walks. We had not gone many paces when I saw, proceeding from every walk, long lines of women guarded by nurses. How many there were! Every way I looked, I could see them in the queer dresses, comical straw hats and shawls, marching slowly around. I eagerly watched the passing lines, and a thrill of horror crept over me at the sight. Vacant eyes and meaningless faces, and their tongues uttered meaningless nonsense. One crowd passed, and I noted by nose as well as eyes that they were fearfully dirty. "Who are they?" I asked of a patient near me. "They are considered the most violent on the island," she replied. "They are from the lodge, the first building with the high steps." Some were yelling, some were cursing, others were singing or praying or preaching as the fancy struck them, and they made up the most miserable collection of humanity I had ever seen. As the din of their passing faded into the distance, there came another sight I can never forget. A long cable rope fastened to wide leather belts, and these belts locked around the waists of 52 women. At the end of the rope was a heavy iron cart, and in it two women, one nursing a sore foot, another screaming at some nurse, saying, "You beat me and I shall not forget it. You want to kill me." And then she would sob and cry. The women on the rope, as the patients call it, were each busy on their individual freaks. Some were yelling all the while. One who had blue eyes saw me look at her, and she turned as far as she could, talking and smiling, with that terrible, horrifying look of absolute insanity stamped on her. The doctors might safely judge on her case. The horror of that sight to one who had never been near an insane person before was something unspeakable. "God help them," breathed Miss Neville. "It's so dreadful, I cannot look." On they passed, but for their places to be filled by more. Can you imagine the sight? According to one of the physicians, there are 1,600 insane women on Blackwell's Island. Mad. What can be half so horrible? My heart thrilled with pity when I looked on an old, gray-haired woman talking aimlessly to space. One woman had on a straitjacket, and two women had to drag her along. Crippled, blind, old, young, homely and pretty, one senseless mass of humanity. No fate could be worse. I looked at the pretty lawns, which I had once thought was such a comfort to the poor creatures confined on the island, and laughed at my own notions. What enjoyment is it to them? They are not allowed on the grass. It is only to look at. I saw some patients eagerly and caressingly lift a nut or a colored leaf that had fallen on the path, but they were not permitted to keep them. The nurses would always compel them to throw their little bit of God's comfort away. As I passed a low pavilion, where a crowd of helpless lunatics were confined, I read a motto on the wall: "While I live, I hope." The absurdity of it struck me forcibly. I would have liked to put above the gates that open to the asylum, "He who enters here leaveth hope behind." During the walk, I was annoyed a great deal by nurses who had heard my romantic story calling to those in charge of us to ask which one I was. I was pointed out repeatedly. It was not long until the dinner hour arrived, and I was so hungry that I felt I could eat anything. The same old story of standing for half and three quarters of an hour in the hall was repeated before we got down to our dinners. The bowls in which we had our tea were now filled with soup, and on a plate was one cold boiled potato and a chunk of beef, which, on investigation, proved to be slightly spoiled. There were no knives or forks, and the patients looked fairly savage as they took the tough beef in their fingers and pulled in opposition to their teeth. Those toothless or with poor teeth could not eat it. One tablespoon was given for the soup, and a piece of bread was the final entree. Butter is never allowed at dinner, nor coffee or tea. Miss Mayard could not eat, and I saw many of the sick ones turn away in disgust. I was getting very weak from the want of food and tried to eat a slice of bread. After the first few bites, hunger asserted itself, and I was able to eat all but the crusts of the one slice. Superintendent Dent went through the sitting room, giving an occasional, "How do you do? How are you today?" here and there among the patients. His voice was as cold as the hall, and the patients made no movement to tell him of their sufferings. I asked some of them to tell how they were suffering from the cold and insufficiency of clothing, but they replied that the nurse would beat them if they told. I was never so tired as I grew sitting on those benches. Several of the patients would sit on one foot or sideways to make a change, but they were always reproved and told to sit up straight. If they talked, they were scolded and told to shut up. If they wanted to walk around in order to take the stiffness out of them, they were told to sit down and be still. What, excepting torture, would produce insanity quicker than this treatment? Here is a class of women sent to be cured. I would like the expert physicians who are condemning me for my action, which has proven their ability, to take a perfectly sane and healthy woman, shut her up and make her sit from 6 a.m. until 8 p.m. on straight back benches, do not allow her to talk or move during these hours, give her no reading and let her know nothing of the world or its doings, give her bad food and harsh treatment, and see how long it will take to make her insane. 2 months would make her a mental and physical wreck. I have described my first day in the asylum, and as my other 9 were exactly the same in the general run of things, it would be tiresome to tell about each. In giving this story, I expect to be contradicted by many who are exposed. I merely tell in common words, without exaggeration, of my life in a madhouse for 10 days. The eating was one of the most horrible things. Excepting the first 2 days after I entered the asylum, there was no salt for the food. The hungry and even famishing women made an attempt to eat the horrible messes. Mustard and vinegar were put on meat and in soup to give it a taste, but it only helped to make it worse. Even that was all consumed after 2 days, and the patients had to try to choke down fresh fish just boiled in water, without salt, pepper, or butter. Mutton, beef, and potatoes without the faintest seasoning. The most insane refused to swallow the food and were threatened with punishment. In our short walks, we passed the kitchen where food was prepared for the nurses and doctors. There we got glimpses of melons and grapes and all kinds of fruits, beautiful white bread and nice meats, and the hungry feeling would be increased tenfold. I spoke to some of the physicians, but it had no effect, and when I was taken away, the food was yet unsalted. My heart ached to see the sick patients grow sicker over the table. I saw Miss Tilly Mayard so suddenly overcome at a bite that she had to rush from the dining room, and then got a scolding for doing so. When the patients complained of the food, they were told to shut up, that they would not have as good if they were at home, and that it was too good for charity patients. A German girl, Louise, I've forgotten her last name, did not eat for several days, and at last one morning she was missing. From the conversation of the nurses, I found she was suffering from a high fever. Poor thing. She told me she unceasingly prayed for death. I watched the nurses make a patient carry such food as the well ones were refusing up to Louise's room. Think of that stuff for a fever patient. Of course she refused it. Then I saw a nurse, Miss McCartan, go to test her temperature, and she returned with a report of it being some 150 degrees. I smiled at the report, and Miss Group, seeing it, asked me how high my temperature had ever run. I refused to answer. Miss Grady then decided to try her ability. She returned with a report of 99 degrees. Miss Tilly Mayard suffered more than any of us from the cold, and yet she tried to follow my advice to be cheerful and try to keep up for a short time. Superintendent Dent brought in a man to see me. He felt my pulse and my head and examined my tongue. I told them how cold it was, and assured them that I did not need medical aid, but that Miss Mayard did, and that they should transfer their attentions to her. They did not answer me, and I was pleased to see Miss Mayard leave her place and come forward to them. She spoke to the doctors and told them she was ill, but they paid her no attention. The nurses came and dragged her back to the bench, and after the doctors left, they said, "After a while, when you see that the doctors will not notice, you will quit running up to them." Before the doctors left me, I heard one say, I cannot give it in his exact words, that my pulse and eyes were not that of an insane girl. But Superintendent Dent assured him that in cases such as mine, such tests failed. After watching me for a while, he said my face was the brightest he'd ever seen for a lunatic. The nurses had on heavy undergarments and coats, but they refused to give us shawls. Nearly all night long, I listened to a woman cry about the cold and beg for God to let her die. Another one yelled "murder" at frequent intervals, and "police" at others, until my flesh felt creepy. The second morning, after we'd had our endless set for the day, two of the nurses, assisted by some patients, brought the woman in who had begged the night previous for God to take her home. I was not surprised at her prayer. She appeared easily 70 years old, and she was blind. Although the halls were freezing cold, that old woman had no more clothing on than the rest of us, which I have described. When she was brought into the sitting room and placed on the hard bench, she cried, "What are you doing with me? I'm so cold. Why can't I stay in bed or have a shawl?" And then she would get up and endeavor to feel her way to leave the room. Sometimes the attendants would jerk her back to the bench, and again they would let her walk and heartlessly laugh when she bumped against the table or the edge of the benches. At one time, she said the heavy shoes which charity provides hurt her feet, and she took them off. The nurses made two patients put them on her again, and when she did it several times and fought against having them on, I counted seven people at her at once trying to put the shoes on. The old woman then tried to lie down on the bench, but they pulled her up again. It sounded so pitiful to hear her cry, "Oh, give me a pillow and pull the covers over me, I'm so cold." At this, I saw Miss Group sit down on her and run her cold hands over the woman's face and down inside the neck of her dress. At the old woman's cries, she laughed savagely, as did the other nurses, and repeated her cruel action. That day, the old woman was carried away to another ward.